Everyone, thanks to the community members that are here. And as some of you may know, I have a kind of background in teaching, so that this may come off like teaching a little bit, which I can't really help. And what I did, I'll start by saying what I did, because at some point through a weird process, I decided on studying three historical conflicts and trying to figure out the process work structure behind them and how we can actually understand them in process work terms. Those three conflicts were the French Revolution, Second World War, and the Cold War. The whole thing came out too big as a presentation, so I kind of decided that we could actually focus just on the French Revolution. That's for reasons of being a little bit shorter. And because I was kind of afraid that the other two might actually set off a group process, which I was kind of trying to avoid. Okay, that's the first thing. The other thing is that it's going to happen. Yes, it's going to happen. Yes, I just mentioned it. Thank you. The other thing was that the first real job that I actually wanted to do in my life, except from owning a coffee place, which is not a real job anyway, was to become a historian. And at some point this year, I kind of revisited this. And I read an amazing book, The History of the World, Penguin History of the World, by an English guy. He died a few years back, a couple of years back, named J.M. Roberts. And it's a huge, like 1,000 pages book. And in the foreword, this guy, this professor, was actually saying that this is his understanding of history as a white, middle-class male, Western male. And I think it was just this term used by a very mainstream historian in some very mainstream university that got me interested in history again. So, the key word on the title, as I have already stated, is subjectively, which means that because all three subjects were huge, I kind of read a lot of books and just decided on what I was finding interesting enough to mention and work on it. So this is not a complete history, not by any term. Okay. I like that one. It's a quote day. I'm not doing any questions. I'm not giving out prizes. But I found that quote from Kurt Vonnegut, and I just realized that the only thing we can actually learn from history is that it repeats itself and it's always a surprise. Karl Marx had actually said the exact same thing. I found it a little bit controversial to just put it in print, but I will say it either way, that history always repeats itself, the first time as a tragedy and the second time as a farce, which was also very entertaining. And this is the first thing that got me interested in the French Revolution, like, oh my God, 20 years back. I was around 10 years old and my mom had got me these books, a series of books with the history of the world and humanity, with pictures for children. Well, this is not an actual picture for children, but that picture was there. And this is a guy named Marat. Marat was one of the revolutionaries that got murdered. His story is more or less the story, it could be the story of the French Revolution. The guy was a scientist and a philosopher. He got very attached to the aristocracy, but then around 1789, when the French Revolution happened, he wrote a book about the friend, he was the friend of the people. He was the guy that, after the first breaking of the French Revolution, he was involved in the terror. The terror was the actual executing of nobles, aristocrats. He had a skin disease and he was forced to take baths every day to just make it better. And he was killed in his bath. So history actually starts with a nice bloodbath, or at least my interest in that, in the very literal sense of the word. He was killed by a woman named Charlotte Corday, who gained entrance to his house by asking for help. And he was nice enough to admit her in his house, to let her, yes, and she killed him. And at her trial, she said another very controversial thing, that I had to kill one man just to save 100,000 lives. And in some part, this is the story of the French Revolution. An ordinary guy that actually, he was a scientist, he was very affiliated to the, to the nobility, and he became a revolutionary friend of the people. He wanted equality, as all of the French Revolution did. And he stepped on the other side. He became the oppressor. He became the one that everyone was afraid of. So another member of a minority group, and actually a woman, came in and she became the bad guy. She killed him. Mariah was considered to be a hero in the beginning. A little time, well, a little in history terms, time after his death, his position in history was reappraised, and then everyone considered him to be the actual bad guy, and Charlotte Corday's position in history was reappraised too, and she was the good guy that saved the world from the bad guy. But this is just a changing of roles that keeps happening, it keeps happening, it keeps happening. And the other thing that I found very interesting when I was reading history was that it was a huge gray area. Nothing could be read as black and white. Everything was gray. You couldn't actually distinguish good guys from bad guys. Anyway, to the actual facts. That's the story behind my starting the final project. The French society, it was, had very, very, very clear roles. It had the clergy, where people from all orders were accepted, the nobility, the bourgeoisie, and the actual peasantry. Three estates, more or less, as they were called. The nobility was the first estate, the bourgeoisie and the peasantry were the third, the second or the third estates. And it was a pretty hierarchical society. Social divisions were defined by land ownership. Whoever had most land was the top dog, in a way. And of course there was also a king, I kind of forgot to mention about that. And at that time, around the French Revolution, there in Europe started to happen a huge rise of philanthropy, not in the terms that we're actually using today to describe philanthropy, but in terms of people, the dreaming behind that, as I, in my understanding, were that privileged people, bourgeois and nobles, aristocrats, were starting to get afraid of the peasantry, of the people that didn't have a lot. So philanthropy was a way to make friends with the majority of the population that they were kind of being afraid of. The philosophers, well, you have all the philosophers, the French philosophers, Voltaire, etc., 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 who actually structured a way of thinking for the people. And then, before the French Revolution, there was the American Revolution. France had actually sent troops here to support the American Revolution, and that was a huge ghost role in the French Revolution. And the sense of nationhood. It was the first time in Europe's history that nations started to become clearly divided. Okay. Another interesting thing, what I found to be very interesting, is that the French Revolution actually started from the aristocrats, not the people, not the bourgeoisie. The aristocrats were those who first rose and opposed the king because they didn't want to make some financial sacrifices to face a financial crisis that had happened. And they actually formed the resistance organizations. And that was the first blow to the king. The king during that whole thing was kind of absent, although everyone was kind of expecting him to take the role of the elder. Those of you that had saw Sofia Coppola's movie, Marie Antoinette, you know what I'm talking about. Actually, just, anyway. Okay, then we had the bourgeois revolution. There was a convention named the Estat General. My French accent is even worse than my English accent. Anyway, the whole thing was that this convention included people from all three orders, nobles, bourgeois, and the people, what was known as the people. And because nobility had resisted to the royal offer, the king asked for the Estat General convene. And then the bourgeoisie actually thought of that as a permission of the king to express their own opinions. The aristocrats would not consider that whole thing. An unspoken war began, and the nobility actually blocked the convention, this convention, and that was the first act of war. The process of Stark's rule behind all this was kind of clear to me in some strange ways. I can ask questions, but then again, no. It was a thing where the bourgeoisie couldn't actually deal with their own rank, and the bourgeoisie at that time in France was a very rich order. They had money. They were starting to rise. But the king was still a ghost role and the elder that they needed permission from. So it went something like that. The first conflict in the French Revolution was actually between the nobles and the bourgeois. The king was not even a part of it. As roles, there were here the privileged and the underprivileged. The petty bourgeoisie and the people were the ghost roles. They were never mentioned. And in that way, the conflict was still between the privileged roles. Both the nobility and the bourgeoisie were kind of privileged. And the king was trying to be the elder, but the king himself was trying to remain neutral in that whole thing. So it didn't really go nowhere. The hotspot, that was a funny hotspot. They were asked, it was a very interesting hotspot actually, they were actually asked to present to the king the three orders. So the king actually ordered them to present in their full attires. And the nobility's attire was, well, the way you can all imagine an aristocrat being. Very, very, very impressive, very magnificent, etc., etc. The third estate and the second estate were black. And because of that, during a very politically hot period, suddenly all the differences were there. Just asking them to present themselves to the king like that, that was a huge spot, hot spot, the hottest spot. And that created, question?
I've lost track of who's what and who's who. The third estate are...
The people.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. And that whole thing, the third estate actually changed its name. Just by naming someone third, that was, the hierarchy was right there. They changed their name. They became the commons. The clergy was trying to kind of ask for the loyal intervention. The nobility refused, and the revolution began. This is how the French Revolution began. You had three roles, actually. One of them was just a ghost role. That was the people. You had the nobles and the bourgeois conflicting with each other. Yes, Elena.
Did this all happen
in a period of some months?
Yes,
yes, yes, in a week. This all happened in a week, in a space of almost a week, more or less a week. It was that close in time. It was like everything was boiling from way back, and it just erupted in a very small space of time. And the king was nowhere there. The king was the elder that was needed from all over the place, and he wasn't there. So, this is my personal learning. The king was Louis 14th, 15th, 16th. He was in his palace. No, he was on holiday, actually. Yes, thank you, Yelena. No, really, he was on holiday. I'm not really, he was on holiday. He wouldn't come back to Paris. Yes. He was absent. He wasn't there. Yes, literally absent. It was amazing. And everyone was expecting from the king to become the facilitator, actually. He had the rank. He was top in the hierarchy. He was supposed to facilitate that whole thing that was between the nobles and the bourgeois. He didn't. Well, this is my personal learning. When you don't intervene when time is to intervene, things happen. Not nice things happen. You can see that in history. In a group process, you can get away with it. In history, no one can get away with it. By the time the king came back from his holidays, feeling kind of better, that whole thing was kind of, he actually gave the third estate the power to have a saying in that whole situation, to be able to have a saying in who gets taxed or what happens or who gets public, public jobs in the public and all that. But by that time, it was too late. That was not enough. The people actually wanted a constitution. So, 11 here. When you don't intervene in time, the situation gets much, much, much worse. And you have to do much, much, much more. The constitution, at that time, the only country that actually had a constitution, except from the States, who was not really considered a country in Europe because it was an ocean away, and either way, they didn't care about America, was England. And England had a very, very weird form of a constitution and nothing like it is today. Anyway, they wanted the constitution. And the way this happened, well, I think Gandhi actually took a lesson from that, is when the Third Estate just refused to dissolve. They just to dissolve, to leave the convention and go home. They stayed there. A peaceful revolution. Yes, it seemed like a very peaceful revolution. Yes.
I noticed back a few pages you said the Third Estate claimed the name Commoners.
Yes.
Did you still refer to
it? Yes, I still, yes, throughout all history books, they still referred as the Third Estate because it kind of, it's their given name. So I just kept that. I'll come back to the methodology of how I actually did that later. Anyway, what seemed to be a peaceful revolution wasn't really a peaceful revolution because the king kind of saw the revolution happening. And kings are never really happy with revolutions. I mean, that's their role. They don't like revolutions. And the army became a ghost role. The army was getting ready to intervene in that whole situation, and the army was also a ghost role up until that point. The army never intervened at that point, but it was still a ghost role. And then, a month more or less after all that, things were kind of in peace. However, hotspots had already been missed, quite a few of them. So, the popular revolution happened. The popular revolution was much, much, much worse, and it is what we actually refer to as the French Revolution. What is thought to be the French Revolution. The Bastille was a prison inside Paris, and the fall of the Bastille on July 14th of 1789, I believe is the exact date, was a key point for the whole revolution. And no one at that point actually realized how important it was. And there are many jokes in bibliography about what exactly happened at that point. Well, the official version is that they went in the prison to take the guns, and in the process they also let the prisoners free. And prisoners at that point were like people that owed money from taxes. They were not dangerous criminals in there. That's the official version of history about that. The unofficial versions include a misunderstanding in the use of language when someone said to someone that his wife was cheating on him and that someone started the attack to the other side. And another unofficial aspect is that at that prison, at that moment, was only one prisoner. Which is, that might also be, yes. I also read that version very, yes. By that time, the king had lost his power because, well, he wasn't facilitating anything. He wasn't a designated facilitator anymore. He was absent most of the time. Actually, I kind of like this poor king. These are all things that I have done in different group processes over time, and most of you here actually know that. I'm kind of absent or kind of not really intervening, and hotspots come back, and all that things. I mean, he was just a poor guy that didn't want to do that. Yes, Penny? Going on holiday, well, yes, not literally, actually, although I have thought of that at many different points in my life. The king had already lost his power, and in Paris, the first revolutionary committee happened, which was actually took power. They started to rule the state. The great fear of the nobility and the bourgeoisie, that was an interesting double-edge there, because, yes, it made sense. It made sense. When you read it like that, it made sense. Because the nobility and the bourgeoisie were very afraid that the people would attack them and kill them. And that was true. But the people were also very afraid that the nobility and the bourgeoisie would call in the French army or army from another European country to hold down the revolution. And that put in motion much of what happened at that period, that was burning down castles, killing people indiscriminately, and other not so many nice things. The king was still in power, he was still in France, no one paid any attention to him at that point, but officially he was there. At the same time, Europe had a huge reaction to all that, because Europe at that point was full of kings. And a revolution like that couldn't just go unnoticed. And the fear was in the field in terms of all the other European countries were also very much afraid that the revolution could also go there. Anyway, this is kind of the beginnings of the myth of the French Revolution. Three things that the French say: liberté, égalité, and fraternité. The whole thing was about freedom, being free, being equal. That was a whole new idea back then. It was the first time that was really clearly stated, and France being a different country than all the other countries. And that is really interesting because we think of our countries, it's one of us thinks of our country that's something that has been there for a long time, but that's not really like that. Countries, nations, borders is a thing that just formed around 200 years ago, 250. The Declaration of the Rights of the Man and the Citizen was constitutional, and the Constitution was considered to be at that point anterior to monarchy. That meant that the moment that thing was written down on paper, the ultimate power to the king ceased to exist. Just like that. And the Assembly, the National Assembly that actually wrote the Declaration of the Rights and the Constitution, became the ruler of the country. But it was a very interesting ruler. Everyone, they had the last saying in everything. And there was some kind of a democracy there in terms of everyone could be a part of that, but no clear system on how they took decisions. France remained for quite some time a state, a nation without an official ruler. And chaos happened, actually. Okay, this is the myth and all the primary process of the French Revolution. Equality, liberty, fraternity. Men are born and remain free and equal in rights, something that today is kind of a given, but back then it was not. And for the first time, resistance to oppression actually became legitimate. And that was another revolution in the revolution. All that thing ended up that individual effort, intelligence and enterprise were celebrated. Man started to become his own god. Voltaire had said that even if God didn't exist, we would have to invent him. But it was at that point that man was actually celebrated most. And historically, it was a period after the Renaissance that humans, men, made a huge comeback after the Middle Ages, etc., etc., etc. What is even more interesting, though, are all the secondary processes that were happening at the same time. And the secondary processes was a kind of a Darwinian principle that the competent and the strong were able to make it, but no provisions were made for the weak, those who couldn't. Equality was not a given. It was something that everybody had to gain it. And to gain the right to become equal demands some skills and some competencies that not all people have by birth. The ghost of slavery was still there. And although around the time of the French Revolution, for the first time in London, some associations of Friends of the Negroes started to appear, no one was actually talking about the ethical dilemma of slavery, as it was, and they already understood it. It wasn't in the background anymore. It was becoming obvious that slavery was not a very nice practice to keep as a good Christian. Christianity was big in Europe at that point also. And slavery was not touched, neither in the Declaration nor in the Constitution. And that was a huge ghost that would return in the world with American Civil War. And finally, that same secondary process of exclusion, from one hand we have equality, and the other part is those that are not really equal. Some of the French citizens were more equal than other French citizens, even inside France itself. The criterion for participation in elections was the amount of money paid in taxes. That meant that people that didn't have money and they didn't pay taxes, servants, for example, or peasants, could not be elected or elect someone. And that was amazing. Because that whole thing that was about equality in itself was not equal. Anyway, what happened after the first period of the first revolution was another revolution, and the terror was the big thing where Marat got assassinated for. People were being executed on grounds of anything, just because they looked rich, or whatever. The oppressor became the oppressed, and the other way around. The oppressor was the nobility that was enjoying themselves too much while people were starving, etc., etc., etc. And the nobility, all the nobles were very, 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 very afraid. And the oppressed, the people, the bourgeois that didn't have the power, became the ones committing the murders. The king finally got executed after a huge trial where an argument was that he couldn't be held responsible for any crimes before the constitution. That was, again, a huge group process. We're avoiding the group process, I'm doing good here. And, but his role was never really processed. And what happened after a few years, no one took up the rank that the king held in his position. No one thought of what was the king. And in the beginning of the revolution, no one was actually wanting the king to die. No one talked about becoming a democracy. The whole idea was some things to be reformed inside France, but no one ever said that the king should be there. Then the king at some point was executed. And his rank, his power, the one that was actually governing the country, no one took it. Napoleon came a few years after that to just take up the role with known consequences. And the French Revolution actually had many things to do with the creation of the expression of a new high dream for humanity, where a place where all people could be equal and should be equal, and that. And this is still much in the basis of Western civilization today. Actually, it is one of the big bases of Western civilization these days. And this is where that whole thing ends. This is a very useful thing that I found, and I could have just written this down instead of a whole final project, because this is actually the point. All of history is around minorities and majorities. And whenever a minority becomes majority, without any awareness, they are doomed to repeat the mistakes of the previous majority. And all the revolutions and all the wars are actually trying to make up for this mistake, deep down. And this is it. It was very fast. Okay. And what am I supposed to say? Ah, yes. What questions do you have?
Hear me?
Yep.
Is that on? That's amazing, Nancy. I'm just blown away. Like, what, just the creativity to apply process for something happened like 400 years ago. Who would think of that? Apart from you?
I have more recent examples too.
Sorry?
I have World War II happened 50 years ago.
But I'm just saying that just the whole concept is like totally amazing to me. Yeah. Just how are those patterns, which we know so well, have been happening all through history. It's like really unbelievable.
It kind of made sense to me. It made sense to me in terms of, I had a huge process around that whole thing. And something was there that was telling me that I can't move forward unless I understand the past. And it was also, okay, if and I'm just realizing this now, it was also some kind of a test for process work. It had to apply. If it didn't apply, something was missing. Or my understanding of process work was missing, something was wrong. And I was very glad that I actually saw that it applies in many different conflicts. And you can actually do that thing. You have the theory, we have the theory, we have learned the theory to actually be able to dissect the roles, even if this is history or this is today. This also happens today. Conflicts happen all over the place today too. And we can actually dissect the roles and actually, and I needed some meaning, I guess. I needed some meaning of wars and revolutions and all that blood being shed and all that.
I'm actually, you know, reminded of my own project because it started, this is working, with the title of the first book Arnie wrote on world work is The Year One.
Yeah.
And he makes a specific connection to the French Revolution and talking about the cycles of history and things just cycling and developing world work as a way, well, he says it, to stop the cycles of history. So, yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it's I think your motivation is follows in that track. Mm-hmm. But from my study of the participant facilitator, that's what you are also saying, or the absent role, the unoccupied role of the facilitator, that in order for those cycles to stop, that role has to be occupied. That's what I heard you also say.
Yes.
The absent king doesn't transform into the facilitator. It doesn't, it's not there. And yeah, it's a great project. Yeah.
And for me, it was really inspiring to hear that the king was really supposed to be the facilitator, because like leader and facilitator, those two things have been like in practice pretty confusing for me when I try to facilitate the group. And so that really, and also the kings I thought were just leaders. And so that was okay. That was like inspiring to me. And the Japanese like emperor, the Showa Emperor Showa, I read some stuff about him, and I knew that he was supposed to be a facilitator in a way that he wasn't supposed to just take sides if their, you know, their ministers are in disagreement. He was never supposed to take sides. So in that way, he was in kind of in a facilitator role.
Mm.
But I thought that was kind of a Japanese thing.
No,
well, I guess not. So that was my learning today. That oh.
And as I think about it a little more, to take it a step further, all leaders, I think, are supposed to be facilitators at the same time. Even today, they have to facilitate conflicts. If they don't, they look bad. I need to say nothing more. They just look bad. Even if nothing worse happens. We expect of our leaders to facilitate conflicts between members of the government or in the country, in their country, national conflicts, small conflicts, big conflicts, whatever. And they need to be able to take all sides if they want to be re-elected. That's also there too. And if I think of another leader that I kind of studied a little bit for what I'm not presenting here, Hitler was also an awful facilitator, awful, worse than me. Definitely. Definitely. I can take pride in that. He took his side, just his side, nothing else. And that in itself created a huge opposition, even in Germany back then. Even an unspoken opposition, and there were acts of opposition to him at the same time. And in the Cold War, just to continue talking about leaders, and this is the three periods that I have actually studied, so no more examples will be coming after that. In the Cold War, the actual point where a difference was made was when Kennedy from the States and Khrushchev from the what was then the USSR, the whole crisis and the Third World War was avoided after the Pig of Bays incident, where I don't know, Cuban missiles, It was a very hot spot in the history. It doesn't matter what really happened. It was a very hot spot. And what actually kept the World War from happening was that they spoke on the phone. their personal relationship to each other. And it is kind of what we expect in a group process. Sometimes in a group process it comes down to that personal relationship between two people that actually carry the whole process and help resolve the whole process. Before that moment, the two leaders had no direct communication. After that Bay of Pigs, or whatever that thing is called, I'm always confused with that, happened, it was when the direct link of communication was settled between the White House and the Kremlin in Russia, which it was also very interesting.
Can you say more about that?
That for the first time, I saw that the three or four years back, outside the door of a law professor in a university in California, Santa Clara University, Monterey, whatever. And I just thought that if a mainstream law professor has outside their office something like that, they need to be good. They must be good. They can't help it. And that stuck with me. And at some point I realized that what Mark Twain was inadvertently speaking of was rank, because majority also has a high level of comfort in it. When you belong in the majority, you're very comfortable in it. And comfort creates a tendency to kind of lay back and kind of forget what's going on, and you can't really feel the comfort of the other side. And just by noticing the comfort, by noticing that you aren't the majority, that means that you're missing many other things. Or at least this is my interpretation of it. I thought it was a beautiful, very, very, very process work quote.
And is the reform the sharing of the rank, maybe?
To reform, to change sides, take the other role, move to the other role.
Okay.
Do something else, just move. Yeah. Or do something.
It's an interesting rereading of reform, like reform, like shapeshift into another role.
Yes.
Like
literally, it's that. Yeah. I mean, it's take another form.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious because you opened your talk with Kurt Vonnegut, who's a kind of a comic writer.
Yes.
And the last quote is from Mark Twain. It's also out of a tradition of great comic writing. I don't know. I know you did that on purpose, and
yes.
And I'm curious what's behind it.
Well, the one thing that was up until today, Arne was being quoted a lot. A lot. And I had almost run out of quotes, Arne's quotes. I think we have kind of exhausted the whole thing. Today we had some very nice old quote that was great, and some. But I wanted something outside process work, because this is about world history. That's the one thing. The other thing is that, in a weird way, comedians or people that actually make you laugh are some kind of jokers that actually can say huge truths without getting that much of a reaction. And this is also true. And in the big scheme of things, we're just a joke, either way.
I have a comment about this quote too. That how I read it is that when, like, you find you are on the side of the majority, it sounds to me like you are actually not the majority, but you are siding with it. It sounds to me like more of kind of a hidden minority identity, where to me that it's like you are a minority but you find yourself siding with majority. That means that there is something that your minority-ness is secondary.
Yes.
And so that's how I read it. So I thought it would be really interesting to hear what. Right.
And at the same time, that just occurred to me that quotes are like dreams. If I have many, many, many favorite quotes over time, and every time I go back at them, they mean something different. And that's a very nice thing. I mean,
parties are ghosts too.
Yes. Lee, yes.
You have an amazing grasp of history. You can tell it, like, it's just there inside you. You channel it, and you know it so well. It's really impressive. And I really find myself enjoying you here, enjoy hearing you teach history.
I'm teaching, yes. The teacher thing, yes.
Yeah, it's really, I find it completely fascinating. And my question is to do with when you were, the process of when you were studying these three historical moments and applying sort of like a process work structural analysis to it. Could you talk about how you did that and maybe some also, like, how was that for you personally? Was that difficult? Was that easy?
Yeah.
The creative process around applying
it. It had very, some, I can't define the steps. First, I read this guy's book, J.M. Roberts, The Penguin History of the World, 1,100 pages. That took me quite some time. Very, very, very small font. Very small font. Penguin font, yes. You can do that if you have like a year. And it's an amazing book. I have to say that it's an amazing book that actually gave, it starts from where people started to appear. I mean, human-like forms, whatever, being started to appear until after the 9/11. It stops somewhere that, so it covers like everything. The guy's an amazing writer. He made me really love history from the beginning. And this is also, that book gave me an understanding of the big picture, in a way. And I don't, even when I finished it, I had no idea what the first chapters were about. In a feeling level, a continuity and an understanding was there. And I went back to this book actually many times during writing, but just specific parts. That was the first thing I did. And somewhere in the middle of that book, because I started reading that before I started my final project, or because before I even had finalized in my head what my final project would be, it started kind of making sense. Actually deciding that I want to do as a final project some kind of a historical thing from a process work point of view, that came to my head in like a second at some point before I left Portland after our residency in September. And I grabbed Lee for 30 seconds. And I was like, Lee, can I do that? And she said, yes. And 3 months or 4 months after that, I said that to Lena, my advisor on Greece. In the meantime, I had a nice conversation in a dream level with Don. My internalized Don agreed with that whole thing. The actual real Don never heard about that whole thing before I actually sent him the final project or something like that. That was really interesting. But in a dream level, I had consensus from my study committee to go forward. It's okay. And I started looking for specific textbooks, and I kind of did an internet search and a cross-reference thing, which were the texts that were being referenced more. And I ended up with quite a few books, and some international politics books that I could actually read and gain another perspective or something like that. But the whole idea, that's the cool thing about history too. It was very refreshing from trying to find references after 2003, which is the thing I do in psychology. The newest it is, the better it is. History, you can go back to a reference from 1950, and it's a great textbook that everybody's using, like the one I actually used for the French Revolution. And I made my way through that like that, and in many books, many things were like cross-checked and cross-checked again. And even in mainstream history books, you can find process work terms. I mean, there is a very nice book in its sixth edition about the world after 1945 that actually speaks about the Cold War, that has two great chapters talking about the myths, that exact terminology, in the United States, and the myths in the USSR that made the Cold War happen, actually. And history has that sense of a myth and repeating processes and roles, reading between the lines there. And first I did the whole history thing. I got down to some history textbooks. I knew what had grabbed my attention while I was reading it. I rewrote history. And then I did the process work thing, and I went back to the original text that I had written, changed the font in order to differentiate between the two things, and I started analyzing it as I would analyze a group process. That was the whole idea.
I have a comment. Your project is very interesting, and so for me, because your project suggests me how inspire me to organize open forum, so involved historical phase. So as I want to explore how to involve historical phases of the place, so your project is very useful. So many useful viewpoints, I feel.
Thank you, Nori.
Thank you.
Okay. That's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was wonderful. And I just want to give us everybody who's presented and everyone who's presented in other days another round of applause. I'm so incredibly impressed by the diversity of your intellectual creativity and your intelligence and your interests and passions. It's so inspiring. And here's another round. And looking forward to the last two presentations, which happen tomorrow. That'll be Yelena and Heike. They start at 2 o'clock. It was my fault. At some point I said 2:15, and that got carried on. It is, in fact, 2 o'clock tomorrow and 3:30 for yours, Heike. So, and then you're going to be presenting Amy's film after that at 5. So, we look forward to seeing you all tomorrow, and have a good rest of the day. Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.